I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the United States is at a critical moment where innovation technology, national security, and economic growth should no longer be treated as separate issues. They are intertwined, and there needs to be a focus on innovation in key tech areas, as well as the development of public policy, a roadmap for the rebuilding of domestic manufacturing to create a shared domestic prosperity from these breakthroughs. Semiconductors, biotechnology, critical minerals, drones, quantum computing, and advanced manufacturing, these are the future. And the United States has deep scientific and critical strengths here, but has allowed too much production capacity to move overseas. We're going to be hearing about priority technologies, ensuring U.S. security, and shared prosperity. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It's a story that has been repeated over and over. The United States develops a new technology, but the production of that new tech goes overseas, and with it goes the jobs and economic growth. American universities, national labs, and companies, they're strong in R&D in things like solar, semiconductor design, batteries, advanced materials, so many areas. But once technologies are moved from the lab, they go to the factory, and then the U.S. often allows production to migrate offshore in search of lower cost. Over time, that meant not just losing factory jobs, but also losing the critical knowledge that comes from building at scale, process engineering, supplier networks, tooling, quality control, and rapid iteration. Now, this is no longer a story that the United States can afford economically and also for national security, because we are falling behind. In the new book, Priority Technologies, Ensuring U.S. Security and Shared Prosperity, it focuses on six areas that will shape the country's future competitiveness: semiconductors, biotechnology, critical minerals, drones, quantum computing, and advanced manufacturing. And the nation must do a better job in the development of these areas, but also in the production of it at scale. So how are we going to do that? Today, we're joined by Elizabeth V. Reynolds. She is the editor of Priority Technologies. She is an MIT professor of practice focused on systems of innovation, manufacturing, and industrial competitiveness in the context of national and regional economic development. And also Jesus Del Alamo. He is a contributor to the book and a professor of electrical engineering in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT. And welcome both y'all to The Source.
Thank you so much. Here.
So, Liz, why is this the right time for this book? Why do we need this book right now?
Well, it's become obvious, I hope, to everyone that the geopolitics of the world are really changing. And what we used to see as a narrow view of national security, military focus, for example, is now really expanded to national and economic security. And as we are developing a position in across new technologies for the country, what we see is a real need for the U.S. to regain or gain global leadership in key technologies that are important today, whether it's to our defense or our economic growth, and will be very important in the frontier technologies for the rest of the century.
Jesus, the computer chips seem to be really the poster child for what is happening right now. Of course, this is something that the United States, we were the innovator, and now we are trying to catch up. What happened?
Well, what happened is, as you mentioned in your introduction, is that over time, manufacturing moved overseas. Governments around the world provided very significant incentives for manufacturing companies to establish their fabs, the semiconductor factories, overseas, and in fact, not just competitors set up fabs there, but also American companies set up their fabs overseas. In fact, at some point, more than 50% of the fab of the chip production by American companies was actually taking place overseas. And with that, as you mentioned in your introduction, innovation really has also gone away, because a lot of innovation happens at the manufacturing floor. And so we really need to bring it back, and that is what the CHIPS Act has been trying to do in the last few years.
Right. So there's been major investment in the United States trying to bring chip manufacturing mainly from Taiwan coming to places like Texas. Isn't that working?
Yes, it is working. The incentives that were created by the CHIPS Act under the Biden administration have been truly remarkably effective. So the numbers are somewhere around $33, $35 billion that have been invested by the government to foster the setup of manufacturing fabs in the United States. They have generated in excess of $600 billion of private investments in the United States to set up manufacturing lines of various kinds in the semiconductor area. So the leverage that the CHIPS Act has produced is truly remarkable.
Liz, is China, of course, this is call out China, that's our main competitor in this area. Do they have a strategy banking on that this is going to happen? I mean, we've seen China treating manufacturing as a strategic national project. Beijing and provincial governments, they've used subsidies, cheap land, low-cost financing, public procurement, export support, and coordinated industrial policy in order to really make the most out of American technology.
Yes, absolutely. No, the Chinese have been extremely successful in their industrial strategy, which really has been a sustained effort over about the last 20 years to build capabilities, particularly in manufacturing, but more recently in some of the innovative, you know, high-tech frontier technologies. There's a report that was done by an Australian think tank funded in part by their Department of Defense, which showed that 20 years ago, the US led China in 60 out of 64 frontier technologies. And if, as of 3 years ago, that had completely flipped, and China had surpassed the US in 57 out of those 64 priority technologies. Very dramatic and concerning area. And so what we need to do is not, I think, take on China in terms of the scale or scope of their work. Obviously, they're a huge country. They graduate, for example, 10x the number of engineers we graduate. As you said, they put enormous amounts of funding into, and a lot of it wasteful, into building these capabilities. And they're competing on commodity products like with Africa, and on high-end value-added products like semiconductors with the U.S. What we want to do is really figure out and invest in our competitive advantages, our strengths in some of the higher value-added work, and places where we can actually leapfrog in the technology.
But what China has created, it seems to be a self-reinforcing advantage. They now have supply chains that are lock solid. They have the biggest factories in order to do this. In order to leapfrog them, it's going to take a lot of investment, focused policies.
This is true, but I will say that you know, I think we've noted, as a country, we have come around to understanding this challenge. The previous administration, the current administration, are really, you know, focused on ways in which we can be leveraging our innovation ecosystem. And that is, you know, distinct and different than what China has. And I think that's what this book is really about, is trying to highlight where the strengths are of the U.S. innovation ecosystem, and then how to combine it with our industrial ecosystem. And that's an area we haven't really focused on historically, or at least in the last couple of decades. So if you think that in the 20th century, you know, U.S. innovation ecosystem was very much focused on our R&D engine, a lot of what's coming out of our universities and our investment at the early stage of R&D, and then also in our sort of startup ecosystem, right? The great, amazing work we do with starting companies, and whether those are coming out of large companies or out of universities, you know, that plus the venture capital, you know, industry, which is unparalleled, have all been amazing. What I think that what we've learned in the last few years is that that's sufficient, that's necessary, but not sufficient.
Yeah, and so the United States has its own advantages. We just have to make sure that we maximize them. We got to take a break here. We want to hear from our callers. What do you think about this race this competition in order to have not just technological supremacy, but for a shared prosperity. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Priority Technologies, Ensuring U.S. Security and Shared Prosperity. It's a new book from MIT Press. We're joined by the editor, Elizabeth B. Reynolds, and a contributor is Jesus Del Alamo. This book is a wake-up call. It's telling the United States that we've got to get serious about how we're thinking about these areas of science and technology and development and turn these things into economic growth in the United States, not let China or any other nation come along and say, that's a pretty good idea. Let's build some factories and make good use of that. We need to be doing that here. And you can call in with your questions and comments. Let's go now to Alfredo on the phones. And Alfredo, you're on the air.
Good morning. How is the current Trump immigration policy making it more difficult to hire the brightest and greatest from around the world? I've seen a lot of restrictions in being able to bring these highly talented people and also keep them here in the U.S. Thank you.
All right, Alfredo. So, Liz, you want to take that on?
Sure, I'll start, and then I think Jesus can talk specifically about the impact of semiconductors. But it's absolutely true. Alfredo is right that actually our immigration policies have been a deterrent to some of the best talent in the world coming here. And of course, leaving, we're seeing a lot of the talent attracted to other countries. And other countries, Canada, Europe, et cetera, have very active programs now to try and recruit our scientists and engineers to other countries. So that is perhaps one of the biggest challenges we have as a country. It's a bit of a headwind as we try and build and rebuild these industries.
Jesus?
Yeah. So what I see as a professor of electrical engineering and running a research group at MIT, I get PhD students from all over the world, I get postdocs from all over the world, and it's really becoming increasingly harder to deal with all the myriad of complex visa issues that have been imposed recently. Some of my Chinese students in particular, they haven't gone back to China in like 5 years because they are afraid that they might never be able to come back and complete their studies. And then it becomes very hard to transition to getting a job in an American company. And this is a shame. American universities have been successful in attracting absolutely the very best talent around the world. And then for that talent to remain in the US and contribute to the prosperity of the industry and the prosperity of the country. And that is being threatened at the moment. And in semiconductors in particular, where there is a great dearth of advanced degree graduates, this is a major problem and it really needs to be corrected.
And as of January of this year, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, he ordered all public universities in the state and state agencies to no longer allow H-1B visa petitions to go through. I've talked to local universities. This is definitely hurting their ability to do research in areas. And this is a commonly used tenure track thing to provide H-1B visa, and to halting this certainly seems to be counterproductive in what you're trying to achieve, Liz.
Yes.
Yeah, let me just say that I think that this is, you know, we know from the university perspective how devastating and you know, impactful this has been just in the last year. And I think the ramifications are many years ahead of us. But also the whole opportunity for us to keep our talent in the country after they're done with their degrees so that they can actually be part of the innovation engines and the startups that are coming out of these universities. That requires also providing the visas that keep continuity and also frankly, keep them invested in being here and helping scale these new technologies.
So it may be, I don't know if it surprised you or not, but actually we have been talking a lot about these technologies here on our program at Texas Public Radio, semiconductors, biotechnology, drones, all these things, advanced manufacturing, we talk about a lot. Because it's our local mayor, Gina Ortiz-Jones, she is pushing forward and saying that this is how San Antonio could solve some of its poverty problems that we have. And she's putting a lot of emphasis on trying to take advantage of what San Antonio has with its universities, Southwest Research Institute being here. The Port San Antonio was as a innovation hub campus that we have. So is this something that cities can try to get on, Liz?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like actually that's a strength of the countries is these regional ecosystems. That is where we develop our specializations, right? That is how we actually develop the talent, the companies, the supply chains. And so what we've been encouraging, I think, at the national and the regional level has been how do we help cities and regions invest in those ecosystems, where there's specialization, where there's opportunity, and how does a city like San Antonio build upon all that's going on in Texas, which is truly remarkable. I mean, Texas is one of the leading states, I think, and regions in the country on some of these critical technologies. You mentioned it, you know, it's the semiconductors, critical minerals, manufacturing. So how do you build out the innovation and the industrial ecosystems so that they are helping, you know, bring broad shared prosperity to the region?
Well, you talk about critical minerals, rare earth minerals. I mean, we have them here in Texas. It's just getting to them is expensive and very messy.
That's right. I mean, that's the kind of the irony of the whole thing. Rare earths aren't that rare. They're everywhere, but they're really hard to get to. And it's a question of cost. And in this case, in critical minerals, often there just isn't a market that justifies the costs for some of the mining, extraction, and processing, which is why we've seen the government step in so aggressively. I think in Texas alone, maybe the federal government has invested a couple $1 billion now in not just in the extraction, but also in the processing capacity and other areas downstream.
So, Jesus, when it comes to manufacturing of these silicon chips, and has to be a change in attitude at the fabs, these places where they manufacture them, not copy perfect, but also continuous innovation. How does that happen?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, if we look at the leading manufacturer in the world for chips, which is TSMC in Taiwan, that is a pure play foundry, as it's called, meaning this is a company that makes chips for other companies around the world that have designed these chips. They do not design their own chips. They make the chips and then they send them back to whoever designed them. It's a pure play foundry. And in the US, Intel has been a single, essentially a company, a fully owned manufacturing site that has been owned by Intel to fabricate their own CPUs, their own microprocessor chips for their own computers. And therefore, the process is very precisely customized for these microprocessors. And that needs to be opened up into attending and responding to other customers and responding to their needs and their individual requirements. And that calls for a very different approach to manufacturing. As you said, it has to be continuous improvement, continuous innovation to take advantage of new opportunities, to deal with problems, to deal with feedback. That's a completely change of mind that Intel is in the process of transforming itself to be able to deliver this and then attend to many customers around the United States and around the world.
Let's go to another caller. We have Robert. Mm-hmm. The number is 833-877-8255. And Robert, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and I appreciate your guest's viewpoint. So the current party in power is restricting immigration, and the response from both of your guests there is that this is going to stifle immigration. Now, when I was at the University of Texas 30 years ago to go to their petroleum engineering program, their graduate school had 55 graduate students in it, and 54 of them were from other countries besides the U.S. So my question really is, out of the 330-plus million Americans we have in this country, are there none of them that actually want to step up and do this innovation? And are we required to use foreign workers to do it? Or is it possible to incentivize Americans to do something other than get masters of business administrations and try and make millions of dollars? Thank you.
All right, Robert, thank you for the call. Liz, do you want to take that on?
I do, and I appreciate Robert's position. I'm not going to diss my business school colleagues by saying, you know, that we've over-indexed toward business school. But he's completely right that we have to incent more of U.S. You know, citizens to be involved in and investing in higher education in these areas. No question about it. And we've had a, you know, we've had a sort of a dearth of STEM investment or STEM students relative to other, maybe to other countries, certainly, you know, related to what we've seen in China. I'm not saying for absolutely we need to be building our capabilities with residents of the U.S. currently, but we also see the benefits of the immigrant population at these higher levels of education. So it's not a, I don't think it's an either or. But we are hurting ourselves now if we're going to shut down the pipeline of talent that comes from the rest of the country. I don't, for the rest of the world. Jesus, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a dearth of qualified engineers in the semiconductor industry. I can speak for that industry. And so there's just not enough graduates being produced in the United States to satisfy the needs, particularly in the last couple of years with the CHIPS Act. There is tremendous investments in new manufacturing sites. And so we need all the engineers that we can get, national and, of course, international. So we really need to open our frontiers to get people that are going to grow this industry in this country.
Liz, but don't you have a phenomenon of where quality attracts quality? And it becomes a reinforcing phenomenon so that when you have the best from around the world want to come to work in that lab.
That's absolutely true, Dave. That exactly has been the strength of the U.S. Higher education system, is that we have attracted the best of the best. And the problem today is that we are no longer doing that because the best of the best see the U.S. as problematic from an immigration point of view. And so they're having other options than perhaps they had in the past. And we really don't want to lose this advantage we've had. And I think the other critical part that we have to put together with this is that part of this is about the R&D funding that comes to, you know, that is part of the engine in the U.S. And what we've seen are also threats to some of that funding to higher education. And I think that goes hand in hand with attracting the best of the best.
Well, in the book, there's stronger language. It basically says they feel unwelcomed here.
Well, that's what surveys are telling us. Multiple surveys of international students.
And there are also American professors, scientists who would rather go to Canada and be paid less now.
I don't know if Jesus wants to comment on that.
Yes, I hear that too. Yes.
So, I mean, so it's not just about, you know, funding these areas of research. There's a lot of work in a lot of areas that has to be done in order to secure this. And it's about national security as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot on the table.
That's right. And so, for example, one thing that I think, you know, comes out in Jesus's chapter is our ability to stay on top, actually across all the chapters, all of our ability to stay on top of and lead in these technologies has some connection to the R&D engine, right? It's in biomanufacturing, it's in the semiconductors, it's in quantum. It's that piece is really critical. And so those R&D dollars are essential. And what we saw, for example, in semiconductors is we've seen a pulling back on some of the R&D funding. And that's an area that we just say, you know, that's actually not where we should be pulling back. If anything, that's where we need to be leaning in. And we'll see that, you know, that upfront stuff, upfront investment is just as important and helps now as we think about the supply chain security and being able to make things in the U.S. You know, we've lost that capability, but in fact, the connection between manufacturing and innovation is really tight.
We're going to take another break here. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about priority technologies, ensuring U.S. security and shared prosperity, I want to dig into that shared prosperity part of the book when we come back as well and talk about things like quantum computing and where is all this going? Drones. We know drones are really, it's hard. You can't. There's no, getting away from the drone technology and national defense are like one and one. So we got to talk about that. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Semiconductors, biotechnology, critical minerals, drones, quantum computing, and advanced manufacturing, these are the future, not just for economic development for the United States and coming up with cool things, but also for national security. That is the story told in the new book, Priority Technologies, Ensuring U.S. Security and Shared Prosperity. The book argues that the United States has a rich history in developing new technology, but then we see that technology move offshore where it is consumerized and it creates jobs and prosperity elsewhere. Why don't we figure out a way to keep that here in the United States? The nation must do a better job in the development and production of these critical areas. So how do we do that? We're speaking with Elizabeth B. Reynolds. She is the editor of the book, an MIT professor of practice focused on systems of innovation, manufacturing, and industrial competitiveness. Also, Jesus del Alamo. He is a MIT professor of electrical engineering and contributor to the book. And you can call in at 833-877-8255. So, Elizabeth, as you argue that we need to put more investment and more focus into these critical areas, on Friday, President Donald Trump, they fired the entire National Science Board. It's 22 members. They fired them. They were given no reason why they were fired. They do kind of oversee the National Science Foundation, which spends about $90 billion in research. And the Trump administration has tried to halve that as well. So is your book coming at a critical time where we seem to be getting mixed messages from the Oval Office?
Yes, I think, Dave, that's probably an understatement. And what our book tries to do by looking across these six technologies is underscore actually the important and critical role the federal government has played and needs to play in our national and economic security, as well as the role of universities. It's one thing to say that we can improve upon our scientific and technological engine in the country, and that there are ways to be more efficient, there are ways to bring in AI, there are things that we need to do to continually improve. It's another to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I think that's what we're seeing in many cases.
Well, when it comes to scientific innovation, you never know where it's going to come from. I mean, who knew that doing research on the saliva of a Gila monster was going to lead to Ozempic?
Yeah,
great example. Or the mRNA research that was going on for a very long time before we picked that up to help develop the COVID vaccine.
Right. So it's deserving of funding of just bench science just to figure out how the world works. You don't you can say, how is this going to lead to prosperity and national defense? And the scientists, that's not their concern. They're trying to just figure out, how this molecule works.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to that, there's also the human development side of this whole thing, which is that the students that are carrying out the research programs, students and postdocs that are carrying out the research programs on frontier science and technology, as we have discussed, also eventually become key contributors to the development of the industry in this country. And without that fundamental research, we are not able to train the next generation workforce that is going to carry the industry forward and contribute in this shared prosperity that we all want.
So the Trump administration wants to halve the budget, $90 billion that we spend in science from the National Science Foundation. That was turned around by Congress, and the full budget was restored at $90 billion. But how would that change things if all that money was lost, Liz?
Oh, I can't begin to calculate, though people are trying to track, you know, about 8,000 different research projects have been stopped since the Trump administration came in for, you know, various reasons, and a lot of them not, you know, certainly not based in the science. And so I think the impact is probably impossible to calculate, because we could have, it's, you know, it sounds like X number of billion dollars, but in fact, you know, as Huzu said, the long-term ripple effects for building and sustaining our ecosystems are phenomenal, like phenomenally important. Our quantum team often talks about, you know, the risk of a quantum winter, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, what happens when you stop this investment? You stop the engine. You stop the momentum. It's both the research and the deployment out to, you know, out to the industry. It's also the students, and it also is a signal to the market. You know, really important. One of the assets the U.S. has is a very robust venture capital, risk capital market that's willing to invest in promising technologies. And signals, when we stop funding things, you know, we start to lose that signal. And the private sector cannot pick up and will not pick up all of this important research going forward. As we've just talked about a couple examples, they're interested in technologies that are going to have an impact near term on the marketplace. And that's great. That's what we need. But we also need that basic research that's going to help keep, you know, priming the pump long term.
Right. So the shiny thing right now seems to be AI and building these massive data centers. Sam Altman and company, they want billions and billions of dollars to go into these areas. Is that at the cost of doing that basic research, Jesus?
It shouldn't be. We should be able to do both things. I think those investments are necessary to develop the models and then to distribute the models that are providing these new amazing AI capabilities that keep improving every day. And so I feel very strongly that there is a fantastic future ahead of us as these models continue to develop. But that doesn't mean that this should be done at the expense of making long-term investments in fundamental science and technology to keep advancing all these technologies way out. So typically at universities, we do research on topics, particularly those in engineering, that if successful are going to be relevant, say, 10 years hence. Industry does not work with that type of horizon. They pick up demonstrations, proof of concepts from our labs, and then bring them in so that we can continue to work on new technologies out there. So it's really important to be able to keep a good balance between the long term and the near term. We can do that. We've done it for many years. We can continue to do it.
Let's go to Edgar on the phones. Edgar, you're on the air.
Yes. I mean, my comment is that what sums up your discussion here is that howdy doody won the war. I mean, our education system doesn't create or encourage young kids to become scientists or whatever. They just play around and take drugs, and they don't have to achieve anything to get out of school. They don't have to have any objectives. So that's what we got for it. And you're saying you got to bring in kids from foreign countries to do that. Well,
that's not what we're saying. That's not what we're saying. Edgar, thank you for the call. Okay, so being able to, there are lots and lots of programs that are getting kids interested in science and STEM fields. We see them here in San Antonio, and they're very successful. You see these faces just light up with these kids are being able to experience science, and they want to go into these fields. And that chain of that pipeline from a young kid in a classroom, going to college and going to university and getting that PhD, how critical is maintaining that, Liz?
It's so critical. And I was just actually reminded, I'm pretty sure San Antonio is a big part of the first robotics organization around the country and the competition that goes on there.
Yes.
This is essential as a country, and we know that we need to start earlier and earlier, and you know that it's not enough to actually try and focus on, at the high school level, that we need to see even you know, middle school and others getting involved and engaged in STEM. And I've found it fascinating to hear, even in the areas of quantum, again, Will Oliver and Jonathan Ruane in our chapter talking about ways in which we need to position and educate the next generation to what is this industry that is going to be a, you know, a multi-trillion dollar industry as we move forward, and what does that mean, you know, for our education system. So I think there is, people believe there's a, you know, a lot we can be doing at the K through 12. There's also a tremendous amount, and again, MIT is really working on community colleges and the role they can play in moving students out of high school and into applied fields like technicians, and where we don't need a four-year degree. We know there's a lot of opportunities and jobs that will come that people can take with just a little post-secondary education.
Right. And so, as you say in the book, in the chapter about advanced manufacturing is something that is necessary in all of these areas in order to maximize, to get the production going. Well, you know, advanced manufacturing is not quantum computing, but it is where it's the secret sauce for making the whole thing work. Liz?
Yes, absolutely. I've always said, you know, I was in the previous administration working on our manufacturing agenda. And I think the entire agenda here for the country, both on our defense side and on our civilian side, depends on a very strong and productive industrial base. And that's our small and medium-sized manufacturers, 250,000 of them in the country. And the question is, are they adopting the advanced technology as quickly as they could be? Are we helping them get ahead and be able to deliver on this agenda for across all of these technologies? So if we just wanted to touch, you know, the top 20% of that industrial base and say, okay, let's make sure that they're using the advanced robotics, that they understand AI, that they've got all of this going on, now that's 50,000 firms. How as a country do we get to 50,000 small and medium-sized manufacturers and ensure that they're, you know, really at the cutting edge and really engaged in advanced manufacturing?
Gotta take another break, and you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. All of these new advances in technology, how do we make sure that's going to be part of a shared prosperity? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. U.S. technological leadership is no longer assured, and that innovation must be paired with manufacturing capacity, a resilient supply chains, workforce development, and long-term federal investment. We're going to be talking more about that as we talk about priority technologies, ensuring U.S. security and shared prosperity, a new book from MIT Press. But let's go to a caller, and let's go to Frank. And Frank, you're on the air. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I was interested in kind of the shortage of water, shortage of energy, transportation and such, and the federal dollars on it. It seems like we have entities that are trying to create a shortage of water so they can make money on it, or same with like Enron did with electricity and energy. Can you talk about some of that?
All right, Frank. Well, we really can't be talking about if there's a manufactured shortage of water. That's really not what we're talking about. But water does seem to be a major part of many of these technological developments, particularly in chip manufacturing. Is a water shortage going to be a problem, Jesus?
Yeah, this is certainly a very important issue, right? Not just water, but as the caller suggested, also energy consumption. In fact, chip making is energy intensive, and it is water intensive, and the industry is working really, really hard to recycle water as much as possible. And I think there is a very high degree of recycling that is already done in modern fabs, and that will continue to increase going forward. And to also make the energy consumption to mitigate it as much as possible, and to use renewable sources of energy, essentially all electricity, to operate these fabs. So these are major concerns that that I think the industry is taking very seriously, and that the government is also taking seriously.
Elizabeth Reynolds, let's talk about the role the federal government has in developing this technology and also consumerizing it. The U.S. can spend a lot of money in backing science, scientific grants, but then the federal government can also be the first big customer. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think what we often talk about is like supply push and demand pull. So we can provide a lot of, you know, grants and tax breaks and things to help companies make investments that they might not make otherwise. But what really matters is at the other end, which is the demand pull. Where are the customers? In the end, it's about customers that that help us scale our technologies. And we've had a lot of, I think, good experience, successful experience. If we look at Warp Speed, for example, with the development of the COVID vaccine, you know, the guarantee at the end that the government may be a customer to buying something, we're now doing this in critical minerals as well, can be a very first important step to proving out a technology that then will attract private sector investment. And that's a model that a lot of countries have used. The U.S. is now doing more of it, I'd say, and experimenting in how to design that in an effective way. But yeah, that demand pull that says, okay, we're going to be your first customer. We're going to show how this works at a commercial scale, for example, because particularly in manufacturing, you know, you can build your prototype and that's great, and you can maybe have your pilot facility. But when you're trying to get to a scale, you know, a bio manufacturing firm for pharmaceuticals can cost you up to $2 billion. I mean, these things are hugely, you know, capital intensive. So having some role for the government, as a customer is really key.
Right. And also in defense. And so the government is able to take technology and refine it. And you mentioned penicillin in the book, and I think in the intro, and how, you know, Fleming stumbled across that discovery and it became a paper that sat on the shelf for 10 years until World War II broke out. And then the United States got hold of that paper with our ally and Great Britain, and really rushed to mass produce and refine penicillin. So there is a tradition between the U.S., the military, being able to take technology, not just for industrial defense purposes, but helping the entire society.
Yeah, we this book actually, I think in all cases, we're talking about dual use technologies, something that can be used in defense, but also used on the civilian side. And that is actually valuable, obviously, as you said, for spillover effects, broader markets, but it also helps the industry grow because you have a broader, you know, number of customers. I think the drone example right now is extremely interesting. Like the semiconductor story, you know, drone technology, the core technology was invented by the U.S., Japan, and Europe over the years, and now basically 80% of all drones are manufactured in China. And, you know, that served the hobbyist community, that served our civilian community, up until it didn't. And right now now we have to build drone capability in the U.S. We've seen the Chinese weaponize their control of the supply chain by, you know, prohibiting exports to the U.S. So this is an area where the Department of War is really leaning in now and helping draw both our innovative capacity, which is significant, but now we have to figure out how we match that with industrial capacity and start to be able to manufacture drones. Obviously, we are not going to make all the drones we need as a country, certainly from the defense side. We need our allies and partners. We need to partner with Ukraine, which is now the innovative frontier in the world on drones. But this is this innovation ecosystem meets industrial ecosystem.
But drones, the word is so vast now. Are you talking about the backyard hobbyist drone that the Ukraine turned into dropping grenades on soldiers? Or are you talking about these massive drones that are flown from pilots who are in bunkers hundreds of miles away who are able to take out the enemy ships?
Well, I guess the immediate focus for the country has been on the defense side and on advanced air and sea.
Ground. Now ground drones.
Ground, right. And ground. Yeah. I mean, the remarkable story out of Ukraine a few weeks ago that Russian soldiers surrendered.
Were captured. Yeah, they surrendered to an armed ground-based drone for the first time.
Yeah, it's just, it's changing, you know, the face of warfare, and it's changing very rapidly. I think the U.S. is involved in some of that advanced, you know, the advanced technology. Obviously, out of the garage is one thing, but we really want to be using drones in a way that are quite strategic going forward. And I think that that's a focus now. I think the spillovers for the commercial markets will be significant, right? For delivering goods, delivering medicine, all sorts of things that we'll be able to do with it. But right now, the real focus is on defense.
Right. And you could also use it to have a pizza delivered to your house.
Yeah, I'm not sure I really need that just yet in my life, but I'm open to it.
Okay. So what if you had to pick one of the six that you really wanted to have to had to pick one of, Elizabeth, what would you go for?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know if I can pick and choose that way, Dave. That's really challenging. What I will say, I guess, is when it comes to we sort of divided this in a couple ways. When it comes to foundational technologies for the country, the role of critical minerals and the role of semiconductors are, you know, without question, right at the top, right? Jesus calls semiconductors the oxygen of modern society. So I think we need to maintain our oxygen, but of course, critical minerals feed into that. So I might.
But if we crack quantum, won't it fix everything else?
You know, I'm not the best person to talk about quantum, but I will tell you that I don't think it fixes everything else. That part I'm pretty sure about. And the same with AI. We've said it with my with Simon Johnson, who wrote the introduction to the book. You know, that winning the AI war is not, or the AI race is not going to be enough. It's this broader ecosystem that really matters. So quantum, super important. And in fact, again, another example out of the military right now, the saving of the US soldier in Iran was based on quantum technology, right? This murmuring where they could sense his heartbeat. It's just remarkable technology. And so absolutely critical, but I'm not sure it's going to save all our answers.
Well, let me ask you real quick, because we're running out of time, and I want to get into this closing question. What if we get this wrong? What is the cost of losing?
Oh, the cost of losing is huge. Sorry, I was just about to add, and I think this is relevant to answer this question, that both quantum and AI, which are the two examples that you mentioned, they eventually run on chips, which require critical minerals to operate, right? So we have to get this right. This is the foundation of our modern society. And if we lose leadership on this, we are subservient and we're vulnerable to the kinds of disruptions that we live through through COVID, for political reasons or for natural disaster reasons. And I think we just can't afford that. We do not want to afford that kind of a future.
Liz, I've got about a minute and a half. What do you think the cost of not getting this right? What would that be?
It's hard to fathom, actually, if we were to really fall behind. I think it would represent a way in which our economy would be controlled by others, and that we would not reach the kind of economics prosperity we want for society going forward. We want to continually be improving prosperity and standards of living going forward, and that would be at risk.
And getting it right means that we would have shared prosperity, that there's jobs and economic opportunities, upward mobility available to all?
Well, I think that is the opportunity. Of course, it takes our institutions to ensure their shared prosperity. It doesn't happen through innovation alone. We have to collectively agree that if we're going to build systems and technologies that are going to benefit the country, that those benefits are shared broadly.
Elizabeth B. Reynolds is an MIT professor of the practice focused on systems, innovation, manufacturing, and industrial competitiveness. She is the editor of the new MIT Press book, Priority Technologies Ensuring U.S. Security and Shared Prosperity. Jesus del Alamo, he is a professor of electrical engineering at the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT and a contributor to the book. Thank you both. It was a really fun conversation. I love talking about this stuff.
Thank you, Dave.
Happy to do it.
Bye. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.